late today. It was quite a dramatic couple days I had, which I will not speak about. So we will start today we will start today with a hearing on House Bill 2050. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2050A passed out of the House Judiciary Committee back in April, and it would require, as a condition of probation, parole, or post-prison supervision, that defendants who sexually abused or assaulted a victim at less than 18 years of age could not live within 3 miles of the victim. That assault, we did refer directly to the assault in the first and second degree statutes so that it would only be the most serious assaults. And the bill, the amended version of it, the A engrossed version, has language in it that would require the victim to request that condition so that it would not be an automatic thing. If the victim or a victim's representative requested the defendant be ordered to not live within 3 miles of them, then that would be ordered by the court. There are three exceptions to the rule. If the victim resides in a county having a population of less than 130,000 and the defendant is required to live in that county, then the court would not have to impose that. If the defendant demonstrates to the court that no mental intimidation or pressure was brought to bear during the commission of the crime, the court would not have to order it. Or finally, if the defendant demonstrates to the court or the supervisory authority or the board that imposition of the condition would deprive the defendant of a residence that would be materially significant in aiding in his or her rehabilitation.
Thank you, counsel. Just let me ask quickly, if the county is less than 130,000, the judge would still have discretion to make the requirement, but would not be required. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that is correct. I believe Michael Salvaggio from Senator Ringo's office may be able to explain to the committee why he imposed that limitation. He had some pretty good reasons for that.
Well, that's a good segue into calling him up here. Then, Michael, why don't you come on up? Did Senator Ringo want to be here for this?
Senator Ringo is unable to make it at this time. He should be here in just a few moments.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll let you get started then. Thank you.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, I bring you House Bill 2050A, which passed the House of Representatives.
Could you identify yourself for the
record? I'm sorry. For the record, my name is Michael Salvaggio. I am staff to Senator Charlie Ringo. And Senator Ringo's office sponsored and supports this bill wholeheartedly. I bring to you House Bill 2050, which passed the House recently in a vote of 60-0. It proposes an alteration to current law dealing with sex offenders. Right now, the law states that they cannot have contact with their former victim, and if they do, they are required to leave a premises where that contact occurred. In cases where a child has had a chance encounter, though, even if the offender retreats, the damage is done to the child, and inadvertent contact or even knowing that a contact is reasonably possible to the former offender can have severe repercussions to the child in the form of anxiety, clinical sleeping disorders, and the child being more likely to resort to self-destructive coping mechanisms later on in life. House Bill 2050 seeks to protect the victim by limiting chances of inadvertent contact by imposing a certain restricted area where that offender could not relocate to. For constitutional reasons, it does not limit travel, and there are certain county restrictions, which I'm going to go into in just a moment. The limitation of adult offenders is on the request of the victim. Upon that request, during a period of probation or other post-prison supervision, the offender cannot reside within 3 miles of the victim with certain exemptions, as counsel pointed out. The reason that counties under 130,000 were exempted was because current law states that that offender shall not be relocated outside of the county in which the crime took place, and a judge and or board has the authority to waive that. But if the default position that they need to stay into that county remains in effect, counties under 130,000 residents do not have sufficient residential areas to ensure that there will be a fair amount of housing available for offenders. We decided to omit those counties based on an Iowa law that failed a constitutional challenge based on similar grounds. Without a sufficient amount of housing for offenders to relocate in, it presents a valid constitutional challenge, and this bill avoids that. The
Senator Pazansky.
Michael, could you go over that again about the 130,000, how you got there, because I didn't track
absolutely
why that number was selected.
When we selected the mile radius and also selected the county population that would be the threshold for applying this law, it was a sliding scale. The smaller we made the radius, the more counties it could potentially apply to, because we have to ensure that wherever the victim lives, once that radius is applied, the offender still has sufficient housing available to them. If we made the radius extremely small, it would apply to just about every single county in the state. If we made the radius extremely large, it would apply only to the largest counties in the state. We started with an area of about 4 miles, I think, since that was we thought that would give a great assurance that no community common areas such as supermarkets or post offices would be used by both the offender and the victim. However, that radius was large and applied only to, I believe, Multnomah County, since most other counties, in most other counties, one would see examples of a victim living in the middle of town, and then about 90% of the county's developed area became out of bounds for the offender, and that presented a potential challenge to the bill. We went down to 3 miles, and it applied to counties which are listed for you in the handout that you should be getting: Clackamas, Deschutes, Jackson, Lane, Marion, Multnomah, and Washington County.
And then is this 3 miles as the crow flies, or is it driving distance?
Chair Burdick, as I understand, the distance would be as the crow flies. That is the standard that we based our research on. We pulled over many maps of many counties and based that length on where we had identified common commercial and community areas to be.
Okay, and I don't think you actually answered Senator Pazansky's question. Why 130,000?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, in order to select certain counties that this applied to, we needed to develop some sort of a mechanism that reflected that this was only to apply to the more developed counties. We chose population. We thought that was the best indicator available to us. Another indicator possibly could have been acreage of particularly zoned land. We figured that population would be the easiest and the simplest for people to understand and look into.
So the way the bill is drafted now, it would only apply to those large counties that you listed.
Mm-hmm. That's correct, Chair Burdick. For the bill to apply to additional counties and still avoid a constitutional challenge, we would suggest that either the radius be lowered, which we would not like to see, or we would have to look into some sort of alteration of the law that requires offenders to remain in their home county.
Madam Chair.
Are there other questions from the committee? Senator Whitsitt.
Chair Burdick, Joe, looking at the blue book this morning, both Jackson and Deschutes County would also be eliminated by the county population figures in the current blue book. That 100. I assume you chose that because larger counties with lesser populations generally have smaller towns, and it's something, there are virtually no towns in some of these counties that have a 6 mile radius, so the person couldn't actually live in that town. Is that a fair assumption?
Good. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, that is a fair assumption.
This, Chair Burdick, it seems to me that this, the way this is written, however, it's written this way to, again, to pass constitutional muster, but it certainly is another example of the urban-rural divide. This does not apply to rural Oregon.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, this is going to be a de facto example of a difference between rural Oregon and urban Oregon. The passing the constitutional muster test was not something that we took lightly, and we would be very, our office would be very open to taking another examination of the law that requires offenders to remain in their county of origin, which I believe is, it has an ORS number. But we would be very happy to apply it to rural Oregon as well, so long as we worked out some manner of allowing for offenders to have an adequate chance of finding possible housing.
But in a rural county, if the situation was such, for example, say the victim lived on the edge of town and the other edge of town had plenty of housing, the judge would still have discretion to make that requirement? Or
as I understand, current law allows the judge and or board having jurisdiction to require that that in those cases the offender would be able to be restricted to a certain area. But that is not that is entirely within the discretion of the judge or board having jurisdiction.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions from the committee, Senator Pozanski?
I only have a question in reading through the language. It says that this is really at the request of the victim. I notice that it only applies to victims under age 18. Then it has a provision in there that says that the victim may request it, the special condition, through in writing, in person, through a representative, including but not limited to the prosecuting attorney. Only question, Madam Chair, is when you have someone that's under age 18 who is a minor as to making these type of decisions, I just wonder as to, you know, is this the right place that we want the that decision to be made, and are we putting the victim into a situation that maybe it'd be better to go ahead and let the parent guardian make that decision on their behalf instead of having the child have to process that that through.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, I would like to ask counsel a question.
Well, I think, go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Mr. Salvaggio and I spoke about this a little bit. I knew a family one time where the victim's mother was attempting to reconcile with the victim's abuser and actually wrote a letter to the court in the daughter's name saying everything's fine and I want him to come back home. So we attempted to strike a little bit of a balance as we worked through those amendments, because it's not always going to be the case, unfortunately, that a victim's parent or guardian is going to necessarily have that child's best interest at heart either. Although certainly a young child, 10 and under, yes, we would probably prefer to have the parent / guardian making those decisions. And I think, the victim's representative idea and language in there, I think that would cover that a parent could assert their child's rights for them if the child could not. If you feel that the draft could be more clear, I would certainly be happy to work on an amendment.
But the way this is written, if, say, mom didn't want that requirement and the district attorney said, wait a second, this is really a bad situation, then the district attorney would have standing to make this request. Is that correct, the way I read it?
Madam Chair, I believe that is correct, yes.
that clear enough to you?
It is, Madam Chair. I guess the thing is, it can go both ways. I mean, it could be, I mean, the victim could, for whatever reason, have, through their processing, feel comfortable not having that restriction. You could have a parent or a guardian saying they want that restriction, or just vice versa, as counsel's told us. I'm just not I'm not sure if there's any way to balance and shift that in or out as to who has that onus or the responsibility. It's just that I think we need to talk about that on record, making sure we're understanding, because I don't want to see the child to be pressured to do something that maybe the child doesn't want to. And at the same time, I mean, and that could be positive or negative depending on whose perspective. And then at the same time, as you have the representative being able to stand in the place of the victim, it seems like the victim's desires have to be represented by the representative, because what if you have an ADA who says, I think this should happen, and if the victim and if the parent and guardian disagree with that, then I guess you're back in court in front of a judge deciding on who represents the kid or who makes that final decision. And I don't know if there's any good way to do this or not. It's going to have to go through the court anyway, because it's going to be a special condition of the probation or the potential, I guess, release on a parole.
And Chair Burdick, members of the committee, one of the things that we were trying to balance into the request process was that we did not want to give a lot of weight to cases of statutory rape, whereby you might conceivably have a 17-year-old girl and a 19-year-old boy, and the parents aim to punish the boyfriend arbitrarily, for example. And certainly it's a sticky situation, and there are many, many issues and possibilities to be balanced in there.
Yeah, I think I'd be interested in seeing if we can come up with more clarity in that. For example, if I could see a situation where you had a 5-year-old child who was the victim of child abuse. Well, they are very susceptible. You know, if the parent told them, you know, if you make this, unless you oppose this request, I'm going to leave you in the gully somewhere. I mean, I could see a situation where a child could be easily manipulated. So if the child says one thing and the ADA says another thing, you know, it's clearly in the child's best interest in a case like that for the child to be basically ignored. So this provision here, because it's not clear if there's a division among people who either are the victim or speak for the victim, I guess I'd like a little bit of fleshing out on here on how to resolve differences in the best interest of the child. Does that make sense, counsel? Do you think that's a doable thing?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I do. Mr. Salvaggio and I, I'm sure, can work on that a little bit more, iron out those wrinkles.
Thank you. Okay, is there any other questions or comments? Senator Whitsitt?
Senator Burdick, Mr. Salvaggio, just one other question. I think we stated that it was the judges currently have the discretion to place these people under supervision at a housing development, and yet in some housing situation. And yet this law that you have written is so narrowly constructed as to eliminate 31 counties because of constitutional means. If the judges can do that constitutionally, why do we need to do that so narrowly now?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, we have seen cases in at least the counties that are in our district, which are very populated counties, whereby some people essentially slip through the cracks, you could say. The fact is that there are cases in which it is simply not applied, and we did want to strengthen the, in as many cases as we possibly could, the victim's ability to set this restriction. There simply are cases where cracks are slipped through, and we wanted to tie them up as much as absolutely possible.
Perhaps I wasn't clear in my question. I certainly accept and appreciate that. I agree with it. My question was, though, if judges are currently able to place these people under supervision in areas closer than 3 miles to the victim, and that's not unconstitutional, then why is it that we have to do this with 3 miles?
Chair Burdick, I'm not sure.
I think it's a different constitutional principle. I think there's no constitutional protection right now for this situation. This is a statutory issue, how close they can live to their victim. But the constitutional provision is because of denying someone who's getting out of prison a place to live. Is that correct?
But my point is, Ms. Chair, that if judges are currently doing that in areas, in rural areas.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
And why would this bill have to be so narrowly written as to exclude 31 counties?
Well, because I presume the answer is that a judge could take into account the situation and only impose that requirement where there's actually a place for the offender to live. Is that correct?
Well, Chair Burdick, members of the committee, that is correct. The challenge to the Iowa law, which was I can deliver to your offices later when I have copies, based the challenge on the fact that the law was arbitrarily applied that restriction to all cases. The problem, in essence, in that situation was not that there was a restriction in place, but that the law blindly applied it, and that challenge would have been negated with the oversight of a judge deciding the merits of each individual case. In the matter of House Bill 2050, we have the ability to have the law apply these cases uniformly, but the trade-off is that we need to ensure that the other side of the challenge, that there is insufficient housing available, does not pop up. So in essence, the successful constitutional challenge combined the element of arbitrary application and also insufficient housing. In the case of Eastern Oregon currently, where judges have the authority to impose such restrictions, it's not applied arbitrarily since there is review, and that assumes that there will be sufficient housing available. In the case of 2050, the arbitrariness, I should say the uniform application is there, but it's specifically tailored to ensure that housing is sufficient, so there would be no challenge to that.
Thank you.
Playing off of what Senator Whitsitt is talking about, did you have any discussion about maybe having a smaller radius in some of the more rural counties? In other words, it'd be 3 miles in the more populous county, but maybe a smaller radius in some of the other counties that might have taken care of the problem and still provide some kind of security to victims?
It was considered as the counties got smaller. It was naturally more difficult to undertake specific examinations of each county's zoning, and I would certainly say that that's a possibility that we can look into if we were able to have those resources placed at our disposal.
Okay. All right, thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Jeff Wood.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Wood. I'm a sergeant with the Pullman Probation Division in the Marion County Sheriff's Office. As part of my day-to-day duties, I am charged with supervising our sex offender supervision team and our victim services program, hence my interest in House Bill 2050A. I'd like to say it's a bit awkward feeling sitting on the con aisle, as I feel this bill has very good intent and merit. Personally, I hold a very strong belief in incorporating victims' issues within our Reformation mandate, and to hopefully make the community and victims whole again. With that said, I'm here to testify about the costs and impact this bill may have on Marion County alone, and how it may be counterproductive towards the bill's intent. As a handout, I have provided a draft memo authored by my division commander, Pat Schreiner, regarding the potential costs of House Bill 2050. As it says, counties with, and it has been discussed, counties with populations over 130,000 will need to purchase, we believe, a GIS mapping system to determine where an offender lives in relation to their victim. Marion County believes this GIS system would cost us approximately $50,000. This cost includes estimates of parole and probation deputy staff time, GIS time and costs, potential licensing and programming fees, and continuous ongoing maintenance costs and information updates. Currently in Marion County alone, we have 408 high-risk, high- and medium-risk sex offenders being supervised by 7 parole and probation deputies. Of this population, 313 have a victim who was a minor at the time of the offense. This is the population that this law would impact. If one of these victims requested that the offender, if one half, excuse me, of these victims requested that the offender not live within 3 miles, we would have approximately 155 offenders and their victims to work with. We would need to plot where the offender lives and where the victim lives, as well as maintain a mapping and informational database that will only grow over time. It's my understanding this bill is not retroactive, but I should mention the effect is cumulative and would create a sizable workload issue for the sheriff's office as a whole. At this time, I'd like to thank you for my brief testimony, and I'd be available for any questions at this time.
Thank you. Senator Whitsitt?
Chair, sir, I'm totally unclear why you would need a GIS system to determine whether someone lived within 3 miles. You could just simply take a protractor, set it, and make a circle. I mean, and if you had to do that 313 times to exclude the particular offender, that wouldn't seem like it would be that difficult thing to do. Why is it that you think that the GIS mapping system would be required to do something that simple?
Okay. Senator Whitsitt, Chair Berth, members of the committee, the suggestion came at part due to advice from legal counsel for liability reasons. Part of it also is many offenders have multiple victims who may request the same distance between the offender. The reliability of a program, in essence, ensures that we maintain that 3 mile perimeter. And it also provides documentation, a database, information database, to ensure that we are complying with the law. I would suggest a protractor, best guess, may not fit with the components inherent in this bill.
Thank you. You've got a bunch of costs down here that total $194,000, and that would trigger a local impact. And I'm not a Ways and Means person, and we seem to be light on Ways and Means people, but it seems to me we should look into. Are you on Ways and Means? So, Senator Walker, we need some guidance here on how we go about.
Madam Chair, there's a bill we passed a couple sessions back that says that if you have a cost that's shifted to the local communities, that you can't do that.
That's correct. But we need to figure out who, and we actually can do that, but it requires a bigger vote. And I believe it's 3/5 to do that. But we have to figure out, what I'm asking is if we can figure out how we can have that be done.
Madam Chair, I would think that legislative fiscal should have provided us a fiscal about that.
Well, the fiscal impact council just sent me a note was minimal, but did that, council, did that go into the local impact?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, it says this office has reviewed the proposed legislation and determined it has minimal expenditure impact on state or local governments.
Okay.
You know, I don't know who legislative fiscal would have contacted about this. They're pretty good usually about contacting probation offices in bills such as this.
Okay. Well, they did at least look at the local impact on that.
Chair, I'd ask the sergeant if he testified on the House side, because the House, if he did not, then fiscal wouldn't have had your information. Did you testify in the House?
Senator Walker, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I did not testify on the House side, but I believe my division commander, Pat Schreiner, did.
And he's the one who produced this documentation that we have in front of us.
Madam Chair, yes, ma'am.
Senator Walker and members of the committee, I am looking at Mr. Schreiner's written testimony. These amounts were not shared with the committee, this math and the idea as to what the cost might be were not contemplated, were not discussed in front of the House, in front of the House Judiciary Committee.
Senator Walker?
Madam Chair, that disturbs me, and this also says draft on it, so I don't know if that's a final copy or a draft, but I think this raises significant issues, and it's unfortunate that information wasn't provided to the House, but I don't think we can ignore it, and I think we should ask fiscal to just take another look at it.
I'm not finding where it says draft, Senator.
Mine says draft, yeah. Right on the front.
Oh, I thought that was a logo.
And in really shadowy letters.
Yeah, very shadowy.
Sergeant, why is this, does this say draft?
Senator Walker, Madam Chair, the reason that the draft is shadowy, as you mentioned, is because it was...
shadowy in more ways than one.
Yeah. It wasn't my intent, ma'am, but the reason why is because... it was created as a Word document in color print, and when the color print comes out on a regular printer, it becomes very dark. I apologize for that.
But it
certainly doesn't help that my copy is vibrant and colorful.
right,
so.
But why does it say draft?
Because, Senator Walker, Madam Chair, the reason it says draft is because it's a best rough guess estimate at the time. It's as a... my division commander explained it to me, is to give a good faith effort on what the costs might be to Marion County if and when this bill is implemented. It is not set in stone. Figures can change, but it's our good faith effort.
Okay, why don't we do this? Why don't we have you work with our counsel and Mr. Salvaggio? This bill has a little bit of substantive tweaking it has to have done, too, and we'll see see if we can get to the bottom of this. And also, on this GIS stuff, it just seems to me that, and I don't know anything about this subject area, but it seems to me with all the online resources that it's hard to believe that you wouldn't be able to get this information.
Madam Chair, it was actually brought up during the meeting. The one thing I believe doing a Yahoo map quest type search was brought up, and the one thing I might suggest is some of the streets are not up to date. Some of the schools are not up to date. And the information, I guess, as a whole, while can be considered generally reliable, it's not to a level that we would want to base some decisions on. And we would also want to have, with access or creation of our own program, we also have ownership of that program and can rely on the validity of the data that our GIS staff would be giving us. Did I answer your question, ma'am?
Yeah, kind of. I just think that there are other, there have got to be other, like through Portland State.
Resources.
Yeah, there's other resources that you wouldn't have to have your own program.
Madam Chair,
we would be straightforward.
Certainly, Madam Chair, we would be open to any possibility.
Madam Chair, this is really for Senator Walker.
Yeah.
On the bill that you talked about that we had to go through setting the limits as to the unfunded mandates, I thought that when 47 to 50 went through, it had a proviso that if it dealt with crime, it wasn't still under that obligation. I'm just not familiar if you remember if it had any limitations on unfunded mandates to the.
I don't know, Senator. Madam Chair, I can't recall, and I thought it was under some ballot measure or something we passed. I just have no independent recollection of exactly what it says, but I know it exists, and to what level, I guess we'll find out.
Apparently there was actually measures. Mr. Doyle's kind of trying to let me know. I just can't hear it, but I knew there was something that there was actually, because I know when then Representative Mannix and I were working on some different issues that came up into play as to what could be going down to the county level, and if, I think there was an exception to the general rule of unfunded mm-hmm. mandates for crime.
I think we'll put this with council, who has a lot of time on her hands. We can look into this as well in the discussion. It's House Bill, you know the number of the bill. The unfunded mandate bill?
I thought it was like Measure 30 or Measure 10. I can't remember.
It's Measure 30, I think.
Yeah, but not this last Measure 30.
No.
Some other Measure 30. It seems to me that it was the voters passed it.
That's
it
96.
Wasn't the legislator.
Yeah.
Excuse me?
That's 96.
Thanks. Yeah, I knew I was somewhere close in my head.
Former Representative Cedric Hayden's issue.
Yep.
Okay.
And do you happen to recall whether it had an exemption for public safety?
Don't remember that.
Okay. Well, we'll get to the bottom of that, get to the bottom of the fiscal, and work on that language that we identified and see if we can shape this up a little bit. Thank you very much. Kelly Sky.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. Kelly Sky, legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And I did work with Senator Ringo's office and with Council Moad on amending the provisions of this bill, and we basically don't have a position on this bill, but I do think that it does have implementation problems. And while we're talking about those implementation problems, that Sergeant Wood brought up, I think it's important to keep in mind that the victim's address in all these cases is confidential. So there's no way for the defendant on probation or parole to know where that victim lives, where they can live. So it is going to fall on the probation officer to keep track of where the victim lives, to keep track of where the defendant's trying to find a place to live, and to somehow let them know where they can live without letting them know where the victim lives. Mm-hmm. So I do think that's a big implementation problem. The other, you know, questions that remain are, what if the defendant's living somewhere, has been living there for a long time, and the victim moves near there because they don't realize that that person lives there, and then is the defendant required to move? So there are a lot of implementation problems, and I think that Sergeant Wood is right to be concerned about how they are going to be able to monitor that and ensure that it doesn't become a compliance problem. So those were some of our concerns with the bill initially. Many of our other concerns were addressed in the amendments.
Okay. You wouldn't have a problem with the defendant or with the victim knowing where the offender lived. Is that correct?
Chair Burdick, you know, I'm not aware that that address is necessarily confidential, although I imagine that
it's not.
Probation and parole officers, in their own discretion, sort of judging a situation, decide whether or not to reveal that information. You know, I can't say right offhand whether I'd have a problem with that. I think there are probably circumstances where it would be best that the PO is not handing out the defendant's address.
Well, and that I can certainly see cases, you know, like we were talking about in the manipulation area where you wouldn't want to, but it would also seem to me that it'd be pretty difficult to control situations where victims move. Senator Walker?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I mean, there's a sex offender registry, so your address gets broadcast to everybody, so it's not a big secret. But the questions you raise are really interesting ones, and that's why when counsel was reading the bill, I sort of got confused because I'm thinking, well, where is this guy or woman, whoever the offender is, going to live? Because we've limited it so much, and I could see a situation where the offender talks to the probation officer, says, well, I'd like to live in, let's just pick Northeast Portland, And he says, well, you can't live there. What street are you trying to move to? Well, I'd like to move on this street. And he says, well, you can't move on that street. So it seems to me by a process of elimination, the offender could sort of figure out where the victim lives, because they keep having to get permission to live certain areas, and then when they're told no, they can't, well, that sends a red flag that says, my victim must live nearby. I mean, it just seems to me that we're putting that situation in play. And your thoughts on that are about the same as mine.
Right. Chair Burdick, or Senator Walker, I think that it goes both ways, both in terms of you don't want to reveal the privacy of the victim.
Right.
And at the same time, you need the offender has to have the ability to get housing and know where they can and cannot live. And I do think that you put the probation officer in this situation as the only person to sort of be the intermediary. And that it makes it difficult for the offender to know where to live, and it makes, because every time they see an apartment in the newspaper before they go see it, they have to check with their VO and see if they can live there, versus, you know, at the same time them then identifying an area where the victim lives. So I think it has a lot of implementation problems, and I think that this is part of what I've spoken with Pat Schreiner with the Marion County before about these types of issues, because there are similar bills in the House side dealing with whether sex offenders can live in the same dwelling, whether
that's
they can live
now.
Whether they can live within a certain distance of a school. And Pat Schreiner's position has always been, you know, it's our job to make sure that they live in the safest place possible. And sometimes living within, you know, this distance of a school or this distance of a victim is a safer place because maybe they have a family member who's very strict, and it's a very safe place for them to live, and we'll make sure that the person stays on the straight and narrow. Things like that, that probation and parole, we trust that they will sort of gauge what's best for an offender and public safety and the privacy of the victim, and they do that on an individual basis, on a case-by-case basis. And my understanding is that the victim who was the impetus for this bill either was a case that fell between the cracks. I mean, it definitely was a situation that should have been addressed. The question is whether we can do it in a statute that can be implemented in a way that's reasonable and doesn't have great costs for the local officials. So,
and Madam Chair, the testimony, the written testimony in the draft that we were provided talked about the difficulty in transitional housing. I think we all know about Polk County and how they were living in tents in a parking lot, and I think the district attorney invited them to stay in his home because he had no place to put these people, and that didn't go over very well with the community. He must not have been married, because that wouldn't have gone over well with the wife. You know, it is a problem trying to find transitional housing for these people. And the bill that you spoke of, Ms. Skye, got a first reading on the Senate floor today about not housing sex offenders together. So we're creating some problems. I mean, I'm really into protecting the victims as well, but there are some implementation problems that I'm just not sure how to fix. I know that I did speak with Representative Krieger a couple of weeks ago about a bill they were putting together that required all sex offenders to wear a bracelet, an ankle bracelet. I'm kind of heading in that direction because I want to keep track of these people. But I don't know if we can get past the issues here. This bill came from the House, so they must have decided it was a good bill. But
okay. I'm going to take Senator Beyer first because he has an answer to our previous question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Article 11, Section 15 of the Constitution, this section shall not apply. This is the article on local mandates, and the section does not apply to any law approved by 3/5 vote of both chambers, and any cost resulting from the law, from a law creating or changing the definition of a crime or a law establishing sentencing for convictions of a crime.
Okay, this would not fall under that, but it would fall under the 3/5.
It would fall under the 3/5, right, if approved by 3/5 vote in both chambers.
Right. Senator Pozanski?
Yes. And listening to the testimony.
Thank you, Senator Beyer.
Another what if. What if the
offender is living wherever he or she lives, and the victim lives within 3 miles within that arena or that range.
You just discussed, yeah.
Okay, sorry.
I think we're going to, we've got some issues to deal with. I encourage everyone to work with counsel. We've got some very good questions. We're going to close this hearing on House Bill 2050 and open a hearing on the next bill, which is House Bill 2185. Counsel.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 2185 is before this committee at the request of Governor Kulongoski for the Department of Transportation. It would increase the period of time a person is ineligible to receive a hardship permit if that person refused to take a breath or blood test and they previously had been charged with the offense of driving while under the influence of intoxicants. Basically, when a first-time offender is arrested for DUII, if they fail the breath test, they have to wait 30 days for a hardship permit. If they refuse the breath test, they have to wait 90 days. But if you are a repeat offender and you fail a breath test, you wait a year. Or if you refuse a breath test, you wait a year. This would increase it to 2 years if you refuse the breath test so that it more closely models a first offender's penalties.
Okay, we have Benita Howard and Troy. You're not signed up one way or the other. I don't know if you two want to come up together.
Oh, she's got 2003 session bill in here.
Do you need a copy of the bill?
No. The real one's in here, too.
Okay.
Welcome.
For the record, my name is Benita Howard. I'm a member of the Governor's Advisory Committee on Driving Under the Influence of Intoxicants.
Can you speak a little louder? Thank you.
I've had the same thing you've had, Senator Brutus.
Oh, my condolences.
My voice is sort of down here. I'm here today on behalf of House Bill 2185. Its goal is really quite simple. We want to reduce the number of repeat DUII offenders who refuse a chemical test under the implied consent law. They refuse, of course, because they know that a chemical test will help convict them of driving under the influence. And they are commonly told by the defense bar, if it's your first offense, take the test. If you've been here before, refuse the test. There's another important reason that repeat offenders refuse, and that is that under the current law, the waiting time for a hardship permit for the repeat offender who refuses the test is 1 year, the same waiting time as for the repeat offender who takes the test and fails it. That doesn't really give them an incentive to take the test, because getting that hardship permit is something they really want to get. So this bill does only one thing. It provides that if you are a repeat offender and you refuse to take the test under the implied consent law, the wait time for the hardship permit will be longer than if you take the test and fail it. Under House Bill 2185, repeat offenders would see that permit, that hardship permit wait go from 1 to 2 years. And we believe this change will help encourage them to take the test, or put another way, discourage them from refusing the test. This belief is based on experience. In fact, the more DUII convictions that a driver has, the higher the rate of refusal. And that's according to our former chairperson for the advisory committee, who's heard many DUII cases in Multnomah County. And it's also based on experience in other jurisdictions, where they say the main reason that a repeat offender gives for refusing is because the waiting period for a hardship permit is exactly the same whether they take the test or fail to take the test. Oh, pardon me, fail the test. I think the sad thing is that these are drivers who have had plenty of opportunities to change their behavior behind the wheel, and they failed to do so. With the proposed change, the offender can avoid the longer wait for a hardship permit by doing just one thing, taking the test. I might add that this bill passed the House by a vote of 57-1. We would ask for your support and the passage of House Bill 2185.
Thank you very much. Any questions from the committee? Senator Pruzanski.
I have a question. I don't know. I haven't been able to research the actual statute. I'm going to pull it in a second. But looking at the staff summary measure, it talks about the person previously has been charged with the offense. And I'm wondering if that's different than what the actual parameters are for the statute, because I thought that it was based on a person who had been either convicted. I mean, charged, this seems to me that's too... the case could be dismissed. Mm-hmm. If it's dismissed, then there's still sanction the same way. I'm going to look at it, but I just want to raise that as a possible red flag.
Do you have a comment on that?
Madam Chair, Senator Pruzanski, I think maybe it's talking about charge in that summary, because if they refused the test the first time, they may not have been convicted, and therefore perhaps the legal reason for that term is whether they took the test, whether they were charged and refused to take a test or failed the test. If they failed the test the first time around, they're probably more likely to have been convicted. But if they refused the test, they may not have been convicted. But the fact that they refused it would be on the record.
So the criterion on this would be charged, either convicted or charged and refused.
What we're talking about,
found not guilty?
Madam Chair, we're talking about the implied consent law,
yes,
as opposed to the criminal charge.
Senator Pruzanski.
Yeah, I think counsel may have some force. I'm just looking at the language that's in the bill and the actual statute, and all it does is really change from 1 year to 2 years. And looking at that and then looking at the actual statute it references, it looks like there may be a difference of opinion as to... I don't think it's just because they're charged. I think they actually have had to been, as the statute says, previously participating in a program within a five-year period preceding the date of the arrest. One of the following occurred, which is suspension privileges, and then get some other parameters to it. Convicted of the offense or participated in a diversion-type class. And so it looks like there may be more safeguards than what the summary alludes to.
So just simply having a charge and having it dismissed would not subject them to this, even if they had earlier...
If they refused, I think it does.
If they refused the first time around. Okay, yeah. So then the question for us is whether we want that as a criterion or if we want an actual conviction as a criterion. Okay.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Well, the question is, the policy question would be, is it, if someone were charged before and for the first time and did not take the test, and then the charge was dismissed, whether that should trigger this on a second charge, or whether we should require a conviction the first time around before the second one goes into effect.
Madam Chair, you're testing my memory a little bit.
The concept
law has always been that whether they're convicted in court or not of the charge is irrelevant to whether they refused the test or not. In other words,
it's a separate crime to
not a crime at that point. They have, under the implied consent law, you have supposedly given, you've implied your consent to take the test. if you're ever charged with the offense of driving under the influence of intoxicants.
So but you say it's not a crime. It's not a, this is probably something I should know, but there's a fine for it, so why wouldn't it be?
There is a crime for it, but that's a separate offense.
It's a violation.
It's a violation.
Our lawyer here is just champing at the bit.
Well, I'm just, when you look at the bill, I was concerned as to what the summary said. I think the summary doesn't correctly capture what the bill will do, because when you look at all we're doing is changing from 1 year to 2 years, and it has the parameter under 813-430. 813-430 already sets the policy, and unless we're wanting to really modify this bill from what is current policy, it's taking the same criteria, and it's
by
very
policy
narrow.
You mean the policy on implied consent?
As to the basis for a enhanced suspension period or ability to get, in this case, the hardship.
So what you're saying is that if they have previously refused a breathalyzer, then they would fall into this under ORS 813.430.
No, I'm not. I thought that's what I first said, but that's what I'm looking at here. It says the reasons, number one, the person is presently participating in a Dewey diversion program in this state or similar one with other jurisdictions, or number two, within a 5-year period preceding the date of arrest, any of the following have occurred. Number one, the suspension of the driver's license privileges under, and it gives a set of parameters, which is all directed toward DUII, has occurred. The person was convicted of driving under the influence of intoxicants, or the person commenced participating in a driving under the influence of the diversion program in this state or another one. Let's see. And so it's really tied into other things. I'm not sure if
it's tied into a conviction under those.
Pretty much. That and or participation in a diversion program.
Well, but we have a law now that if you flunk diversion, you go back to a conviction. So
that's correct.
But Madam Chair, I mean, just to clarify, if a person successfully completed their diversion program, their DUII was dismissed, but it was within 5 years of the second arrest and refusal to take a breath test, this enhancement would apply.
Right. But what we're trying to get at is if someone was charged with a DUII, say within 5 years, and they refused to take a breathalyzer test, it sounds to me like they would not be covered by this.
Say that one more time. If they were charged.
If they were charged with DUII, they refused to take a breathalyzer test, and they were not convicted and not sent to diversion. It was dismissed.
First time.
Then they would not be covered by this?
And when I look at ORS 813.410, which is cross-referenced, I think if a person was suspended under the implied consent laws for a refusal, even if that ultimately was never charged by a district attorney's office, or if it was charged but the defendant was acquitted, I still think that they would be subject to this enhancement.
It's a separate suspension based on the failure to take the test as compared to being convicted. So that's the part that I didn't read.
Okay, that was the cross-reference where the parameters of, okay, I understand. I think I understand. Chair understands. All is good.
I said it. I thought it was a relatively simple thing that we were doing, but,
We have a wonderful ability to make simple things complicated in Senate Judiciary. Are there any other questions? Thank you very much. Well, you could stop talking now. I hope you feel better. You're next, Troy.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Troy Costales, manager of the Transportation Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. And a couple of things I'd just like to highlight for you is what type of numbers are we talking about in this particular situation. In Oregon, about 25% of all the DUII convictions in the state every year are for second or more offenses inside of a 10-year window. It's roughly 2,600. It means 8 people every day in this state are taken off the road by law enforcement officer because they are a repeat DUI offender in the last 10 years. The object of this bill, as proposed by the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII, was to put an incentive on those repeat offenders to take the test, blood or breath test, when they're a repeat offender, by lengthening the time that they can get a hardship permit request from 1 year to 2 years. There will be changes at DMV from a data processing point of view, which are very minimal, and the safety division would change materials to get to law enforcement, prosecution, and to courts in relationship to this change, which is also very minimal. And as Vanita pointed out, this did pass the House 57-1. One of the questions you might have is, what would somebody be allowed to do if they're given a temporary license or a hardship permit from DMV? And it's a very short list of things that somebody's allowed to drive under a hardship permit. First, that is if they are employed and required to drive for their employment. Second, to get to and from employment. Third, if they are enrolled in alcohol or drug treatment, to be able to go to and from that medical treatment. Fourth, if they have somebody in their family that requires some sort of doctor or medical treatment, to be able to be the caretaker back and forth to that treatment. Fifth, if they are the only driver in the family and there are necessary items such as groceries or taking children to school or other medical appointments, they are allowed under the hardship permit. And lastly, a hardship permit will only last as long as the suspension period is there. Once the suspension period is over, then they are free to apply for a full unlimited license through the department, through DMV. This bill is brought to you through ODOT on behalf of the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUI, and we ask your support for this bill to put an incentive on those repeat offenders, making sure that they take the blood or breath test during a DUI arrest.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Thank you. Kelly Skye.
Members of the committee, again, Kelly Skye with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and we oppose this bill because we believe that there are too many unlicensed drivers on the road, and when a driver's unlicensed, they are uninsured as well. We'd like to see more people get their retain their licenses. That said, the reason behind this bill, the reason that it's being brought forward to you, is that there is supposedly no incentive not to take the test on your on this second time. And last session, that reason was brought forth in order to pass the bill that made it a new offense to fail to take the breath test. So I would dispute the fact that there's no incentive not to take it, because now it is a new offense with, I believe, a mandatory fine if you refuse to take the breath test at all in your first offense, second, you know, whenever it is. So we believe that that incentive is there and that this bill is not necessary.
Thank you. Would this keep people from getting licenses?
Chair Burdick, it will just it will lengthen the period of time before they can get a hardship license to do the things that they need to do. So if they can't get a hardship license to do all of the things that the Department of Transportation just listed, then they're unlicensed, and if they have to do one of those necessary things, they're driving unlicensed and uninsured.
Senator Pisanski.
Madam Chair, I think Ms. Guy's brought up a pretty good point. I mean, I support the concept here. I guess there's two things. Number one, in my practice as a prosecutor, I see a number of people who have been suspended that are driving without any type of license. Maybe what we should look at is enhancing the penalty for the person refusing to submit to the blood test on a second occurrence. You know, right now, I think it's a minimum $500 fine right now, and maybe we set up as a second offense, if they do it a second time, that they are going to be having more of a fine, you know, because it's a violation is what we've got right now. And that might be another, I mean, if you're really looking to try to set incentives, I don't know, by setting up the length of time to get the hardship as compared to having a monetary fine imposed immediately, it seems like you may have more of a conditioning of the individual understanding that there's a sanction that's going to be, and it's going to be pretty significant by increasing the dollar amount they have to pay as compared to protracting the length of time for hardship. But, I mean, it's both ways can work. I think you'd probably get better results or more effective results hitting them in the pocketbook.
Council,
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Guy, isn't it true that at least one judge in Multnomah County has held under certain circumstances that the failure to take the breath test statute is unconstitutional?
Chair Burdick, Council Moa, I believe that's true. Judge Marcus, he didn't find it unconstitutional. What he found was that in a case where I think there was a default judgment on that violation, but that double jeopardy attached to the violation because it was a, and I am not prepared to give this legal analysis today, but my understanding is he found that that violation is punitive enough in nature that jeopardy attached as to the subsequent prosecution on the DUI.
And so the state, or so then Judge Marcus dismissed that DUI. Is that?
Chair Barker, Council Mudd, I think that's true. Okay. I've only seen emails back and forth, but okay. Judge Marcus would be the person.
Senator,
committee staff could tell us a little bit more as to the status of that. When that happened, is it up for appeal?
Senator Pozanski, the issue was actually highlighted for me by Ms. Skye and her associate, Mr. Hummel, when the House was hearing a bill that would have expanded the failure to take a breath test to include failure to submit to urine and blood analysis. And I was not aware of the case at that time, and after we had that hearing and sent that bill to the House floor, Ms. Skye did forward me some emails. I'm not under the impression it's something that the state is going to appeal. I don't have that information. But I do know from the emails that Ms. Skye forwarded on to me that at least in Multnomah County, because of that ruling now, if a defendant fails to appear for the violation traffic date or at their initial arraignment, the state will dismiss the violation so that the subsequent prosecution for DUI can be preserved.
So are you talking about the violation of not taking the breathalyzer?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, that is correct.
Well, that's I'd like to find out more about that. That could be a pretty serious thing if it is as it sounds. Okay. Thank you. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2185 and open a work session on House Bill 2225. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. We first heard about this last week. House Bill 2225 came to us from the Department of Justice, establishes a standard of review for appeals from judgments in violation proceedings and would require the courts to review judgments from violations in the same way that a criminal case is reviewed at the appellate level. Senator Pozanski asked, it was made clear that when it's the appeal from municipal court to circuit court, the standard of appeal would remain the same, which is a de novo review.
Okay. Thank you. Do we have anybody who wanted to talk on this? Just a work session. Okay, I think we already had a hearing on this committee. I think it's fairly straightforward. We have no amendments. Is that correct, Council?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Okay, Senator Starr, do you have any views on this bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, I like this bill. And I move House Bill 2225 to the floor with the due pass amendment.
Sir,
please pass. Recommendation.
Thank you. Sorry to interrupt. Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2225 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Senator Whitsitt.
For clarification, did the appellate court judges weigh in on this? I don't have any testimony from them.
Not the judges.
Senator Whitsitt and Madam Chair, I am not aware of any judges having an opinion one way or the other about it. I would say that it's my experience that Jeanne Quinn, who works for the courts, is pretty good about keeping judges apprised of pending legislation, and she's pretty good about letting us know if there are any concerns, and I did not hear from her on this bill, so I would not I don't want to make any representations, but it would have been my expectation to have heard from her.
Senator Pisanski, did you have a comment?
Yeah, Madam Chair, we had Mr. Fosner from DOJ, and I thought we had someone from the court. It wasn't Judge Swank, but I thought someone else came over from the Judicial Department on that bill. But did you have someone else?
Madam Chair, I wasn't here that day, so I can't tell you what my notes say.
No, Taker was gone.
I know, but I do have in my file written testimony from Jonathan Fosner with the Department of Justice. He did testify, at least.
And I have the witness list, and only Mr. Fosner had signed up. I don't recall anyone coming up from the courts, but I could be wrong.
Jonathan, yeah, I know he was here.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, I think... yeah, I would feel comfortable that this is okay with the Court of Appeals. Are you listening out there, Court?
It does say, Madam Chair, the statutory change would result in small but significant cost savings and increased efficiency in the appellate system.
I'm surprised they weren't here waving their pom-poms on that one. Okay, we have a motion on the floor. Senator Starr to pass House Bill 2225 to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Whitsitt, would you like to carry this bill?
Sure.
Senator Whitsitt will carry this bill. See what you get for asking a question at the end here. Okay. Council, number one, you can go on to better pastures here if you like. And we'll now open a public hearing on House Bill 2213. Council.
Chair Budick, members of the committee, House Bill 2213A comes to you from the Department of Justice. This bill removes the requirement that the district attorney or the Division of Child Support provide withholding services when the obligee, that is, a spouse receiving support payments, is due only spousal support payments as opposed to having due spousal support and child support payments and does not receive public assistance. This bill also declares a state policy regarding spousal support obligations. This bill passed the House with a vote of 53-3.
Okay. We have signed up Rennell Schenkel and Shani Fuller.
Please do. I didn't
know whether she was with your group or not.
A new face for you. Chair Burdick and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ron L. Schenkel with the Department of Justice Legislative Liaison to the Attorney General. I'm just going to give you a brief overview of why we're here today and then leave it to the two experts to take you through the bill briefly. As a reminder, the Oregon Child Support Program is a part of the Department of Justice, and it is made up of the oversight responsibilities being handled in the Department of Justice, but the daily services being done by both our Division of Child Support on those cases involved some form of public assistance, and by 28 of the 36 county district attorneys throughout the state in those cases where no assistance has been provided or is currently in use. Within the program, there are a multitude of services, and many of you have been around for years, but as a reminder, not only do we establish paternity and establish child support orders, including monetary and health provisions, we modify orders, and we provide interstate casework, accounting services, and a myriad of other services. If you have a child support, a judgment containing child support along with spousal support, those two are provided services in our caseload together, but many of the members were not aware of that. In some instances, the child support program also provides services, be they limited, but services on spousal support only, meaning a judgment just between a man and a woman where there was an allocation of support from one spouse to the other. We're here before you today because for the first time ever, at least in my history coming before the this body, the child support program has hit a point where we do not have enough resources to provide all the services that we are required, both through our federal mandates as well as our state mandates, let alone all the services our partners would simply like us to provide to the families of Oregon. So Ms. Fuller and Ms. McKean are going to walk you through some of the issues around these spousal support-only cases, and I will remain to answer any questions.
Thank you. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. My name is Shaney Fuller, and I'm with the Department of Justice Oregon Child Support Program. I am here to talk about House Bill 2213 today, and we have two main reasons for wanting this bill. The first reason is that we identified an inconsistency in Oregon law. ORS 25080 clearly states that the program may provide services for a spousal-only case. However, when the income withholding provisions were put into Oregon law, the term generic term support was used to refer to child support and spousal support to ensure that that income withholding tool could be used for both of those types of support. The language of 25381 operates to require the child support program to provide those enforcement services, including income withholding for spousal support only cases. And we identified this, and there is a conflict between 25080 and 25381. With the exception of those cases where an obligee is on public assistance, this bill would return the status of a discretionary services for spousal-only cases. The second reason is partially what Ms. Schenkel referred to, and that is a resource issue for us. In these lean budgetary times, we've had to look at ways to more efficiently use our resources. And one place where we started is looking at those services that are not federally mandated. There are very few services that the program provides that are not required by the federal government. However, spousal-only services are one of them. And because they're not federally mandated, they are also not matched by federal funds. All of our services, or most of our services, are matched 3-to-1, or two-thirds federal funding and one-third state funding. Spousal support-only services are not. So when we're looking at ways to efficiently use our resources, for every $1 we spend on a spousal support-only case, that represents $3 that we can spend for child support and getting support for the children of Oregon. This bill was amended on the House side. Oregon Law Center and the committee was very concerned with low-income obligees and their ability to get services and get support, spousal support. We amended the bill, and as written, it would require us to provide income withholding services for any obligee on any form of public assistance. And that includes food stamps, Oregon Health Plan, any of those forms of public assistance, we would still be required to provide those services. So as amended, we think it strikes a good balance between our resources and those obligees who actually need the services here in Oregon.
Okay.
Thank you. And if you have any questions at the end, I would be happy to answer them.
Yep. Thank you. Do you have any sense of how many of your caseload fall into this low-income category?
It's about 15, Chair Burdick, we have around 1,500 cases, spousal-only cases, and I believe it's around 280 that are on some form of public assistance.
Okay, thank you. Other questions from the committee?
Yes.
Senator Whitsitt.
Chair Burdick, just one question. In the summary, it says this bill would make the enforcement service for spousal support optional when the individual is not on public assistance, and you just addressed that. How does that comport with the 14th Amendment equal protection under the law? How can you give protection to one class of citizen because they are poor and not on public assistance and not the same protection to those that are not?
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, I'm going to defer to counsel to answer your legal question because I am not an attorney, but I will just mention that there are services within the child support program, the majority of them are free services available to anyone regardless of income level. This is one area where we would be saying for certain people they will automatically come into the caseload, basically because they've made an assignment to the state and they're on some type of assistance. Those are the Oregon Health Plan and the TANF, the Temporary Assistance to Needy Family Obligees that are in our system and receiving state assistance. So it's sort of based on that threshold of services. That doesn't get to your answer of equal protection, but I will point out that those obligees can still receive services through other methods by going through court. They just wouldn't automatically receive them from the program. And then I'll defer to Mr. Sears.
I guess the short answer would be that the class of individuals that would be separated here would be, I think, it would be based on wealth. That's not a protected class. Therefore, the standard that the government would need to reach in order not to violate the Equal Protection Clause would be reasonable basis as opposed to a strict scrutiny, which is a much higher standard. So if the government could show that, or actually the person bringing the action would have a responsibility to show that the government is not acting in any reasonable manner, that would be the short answer. So this kind of separation or different application of the law, I do not believe would be a violation of the 14th Amendment.
And it's, to paraphrase that, it would be basically the difference between a service and a protection. Is that correct? We provide a lot of services to people based on income or need, and this would be one of them.
That's not necessarily how I would describe it. I mean, that's a way to look at it. I would emphasize that it's not, you're not dealing here with a protected class such as race or a fundamental right for that matter. Maybe that's what you're getting at, mm-hmm. Chair Burdick. When you're dealing with those issues, the government has to meet a standard of strict scrutiny, which is a much higher standard for them to meet. They have to show that there's no I can't remember off the top of my head the exact phraseology that's used for that test, which is a much higher standard than the reasonable basis standard, which this type of law would apply to.
I'm
certainly not a lawyer, but it would seem that we're certainly making a class of individuals who are on public assistance. And I was also unaware that the 14th Amendment had to do with necessarily was restricted to discriminatory things. It had to do with equal protection.
Okay.
Fair enough.
I obviously did not make well. The current statute as it's drafted and interpreted, we believe requires the program to provide these services to anyone. We are not attempting to completely eliminate the service. We're just trying to make it optional. Our hope is that while it would be completely general fund-based, there could be counties that will still continue to choose to provide the service, and there could come a time where the state will be able to provide it again to that broader base. So we are still leaving the flexibility in the law. We're just trying to remove a specific mandate that has historically been there for Oregon.
Thank you. Do you have more, or do you want to move on?
Okay.
Thank you.
Oh, good afternoon, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. My name is Laura Lee McKee. I'm the Assistant District Attorney for Lone County. I apologize for my cold today.
That's fine. It's going around.
Okay. I'm here in support of House Bill 2213A. I've been with the Family Law Division of the Lane County District Attorney's Office for the last 10 years. I've been the lead attorney of that division since 1998. When I first came to Family Law in 1995, our office at that time did not routinely accept spousal-only cases. Pursuant to ORS 25.080, we viewed our position as discretionary, and we would review those incoming cases carefully and provide services on those cases where the requesting party was especially in need and clearly had no other resources available either for income or for enforcing their own order. or at least when it appeared that there was a viable collection source for the support. In 2002, the DAs were advised that because of ORS 25.381, that mandated these services, limited services, to be provided on a spousal-only case, as mentioned previously here. I think my purpose here today was to perhaps bring a few specific examples so that you could see how the requirements of 25.381 have played out in the field, in our office, and I'd like to do that. The first example I have is a case where we opened a spousal-only case requested by the obligee, that's the recipient of the support, spousal-only, who is now a Lane County resident. We obtained a copy of the support order from the court of the original jurisdiction where neither party now resides. So we have an order that originated out of one county, the paying party living in another county, and the receiving party living in Lane County. We determined that spousal-only arrearages needed to be established before we could proceed with collecting them. The obligee made a claim for what was owed, and we had to establish that through a judicial process. But first we needed to file a motion to transfer that case to Lane County so that that arrearage action could be commenced. The obligor retained an attorney and objected to the transfer. This is very unusual. Probably the first that I have heard of in 10 years. A hearing on the motion was set in the county of original jurisdiction, which was several hours away from Lane County, and the matter is now under advisement. If and when the arrearages are determined, the case will most likely be unenforceable via the income withholding provision of ORS 25.381, because this obligor has no employer and claims that he is unable to work. On this case, the estimated time spent so far, not including the court's time with that jurisdiction, has been approximately 8 to 9 hours. We don't have an order to enforce yet. The case is still on the books, and we don't see that we will have a good opportunity enforcement even when this legal matter is concluded. Another example is a spousal-only case that came to our office on the obligee's request again. And again, we had to establish spousal-only arrearages before we could begin enforcement. Both parties had attorneys. The obligor objected to the obligee's claim for the arrearages, and so the matter was set for hearing in circuit court. On the day of hearing, the attorneys advised the state that its action had been consolidated with the private attorney's spousal modification action, and so both cases were reset on the trial docket. The obligee then fired her attorney. After an additional postponement, the matter went to trial in the third setting in circuit court. The result on the arrearage matter was that the obligee's claim was found to be unsubstantiated by the circuit court judge, and the court actually entered an order crediting the obligor as being overpaid in the case. Again, we're finding that this spousal-only obligation in this case will be unenforceable at this time. There's no withholding available because the obligor also claims that he is unable to work and he has no employer. The spousal arrearages for the ongoing continue to accrue on the books with no support being paid to the obligee. In this case, I tried to compile the number of hours involved in the written and telephone contacts with the Lane County DA and the child support program. The number of contacts for the program in our office by either party and or his attorneys was approximately 50 separate contacts with the office. And the time spent, which would be attorney time, staff time, and court time, was 12 to 15 hours so far, and we have no money flowing on the case. Now, both of these cases, I would submit, if HB 2213A were to be passed, these are two cases where our office would most likely review the case carefully for take before we took it, because we would hopefully have some discretion to identify and decide that even at the end of all our efforts, we probably would not have any support flowing on the case for the benefit of the obligee. Third case I want to tell you is a case that I believe
maybe we could skip the third case because we're kind of running out of time, and I wanted to make sure people had time for questions. Are there some concluding remarks you want to make?
Right. Well, the third case, thank you, Chair Burdick. The third case was one that, irrespective of HB 2213A, we would take it anyway. I just wanted to let you know that.
Okay, that was a low-income case.
No, but it was an extremely deserving case of the services for a disabled obligee.
Okay. Thank you.
I think my concluding remark on that is only that I don't view this as an anti-spousal support bill. I view it more really about restoring the ability to use the available resources that we do have more effectively, so that in those cases where we can identify that even if those services are provided, that we probably will not achieve any benefit to the receiving party, that perhaps those cases are cases that we would not be compelled to work.
Okay, and if basically if you stop providing this service at Department of Justice, people still have legal avenues to pursue to get the obligations fulfilled. Is that correct?
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, that is correct. There are other remedies available through the judicial process that are currently available. It's just a matter of which forum you use.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the context of the bill on line 8 and 9 where delete district attorney and the Division of Child Support, but you add the word administrator. Who is the administrator? Because if someone still is required to do this, because you're not changing the shall to the may, to a may.
Chair Burdick and Senator Beyer, I believe that was actually legislative council cleanup. The administrator is defined in Chapter 25, and if you read in there, you will find it's the director of the child support program, and then she designates to the Division of Child Support and to the district attorneys. And she has a copy here of the shall and may issue.
Right. Chair Burdick and Senator Beyer, the shall in that first part, the way that the statute is structured, has to do with child support and when we are required to provide income withholding services for child support. So now that, and it's saying whenever services are being provided under ORS 25080. So whenever we are providing services as required for a child support case or a child support and spousal only case, then we are also required to provide income withholding services. And the spousal support piece is further down in Section 2, I think 2B. So by virtue of the fact that those services are discretionary in 25080, they would not be included in 1, so they're excluded. And then in 2B, it includes, again, the spousal support only services where an obligee is on public assistance.
Okay. I think so.
Okay. Any other questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Committee, I kind of had some reservations about this bill when we first started talking about it, but my concerns have been alleviated, and if that is shared by the committee, we will turn to our vice chair.
Madam Chair, we are in a public hearing. We need to move to work sessions.
You're right, Senator Starr. I've been sick. You just have to cut me a little slack here. We'll close the hearing.
I'll be helpful.
You are always helpful, Senator Starr. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2213 and open up a work session on House Bill 2013.
Madam Chair, I move 2213 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2213 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Beyer, would you like to carry this?
We'll get through here.
No.
By the time we get through here, nobody's going to speak on anything. Okay, now we've got some several things here set for work session. We're going to try to work our way through this, and we will probably have to postpone the public hearing on House Bill 2634, but we may yet get to it if we can move quickly. Right now we will open a House hearing on a work session on House Bill 2545. Council.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, House Bill 2545A is sponsored by Representative Ackerman. This is a bill that prohibits a public body from charging a record requester attorney's fees that are related to the determination of the application of the provisions of the public record laws. It does allow public bodies to recover the cost of attorney's fees for the time the attorneys spend reviewing the public records, for redacting public records, and segregating public records into exempt and non-exempt records. It also requires that public bodies provide a cost estimate to requesters before producing the records if the fee is in excess of $25.
Okay, we had testimony from Representative Ackerman, who told his horror story of being billed, to his great surprise, for $876.85. This is the his solution to the problem, and it looks pretty straightforward. So,
Madam
committee
Chair,
members, Senator Starr.
I move House Bill 2545 to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2545 to the House to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Nobody spoke up, so I will carry this. Okay, now we'll open a work session on House Bill 2547. Council.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, House Bill 2547 also comes to you from Representative Ackerman. This bill increases from $140,000 to $200,000 the value of an estate for which a small estate affidavit may be filed. Small estate proceedings are a simplified and streamlined process for probating small estates. The specific dollar amount set out in Oregon to qualify for small estates is $50,000 or less of personal property and $90,000 or less of real property for a total of no more than $140,000. That's the current law right now. This bill increases from $90,000 to $150,000, the minimum amount that may be attributed to real property for an individual to file a small estate proceeding. This increases the overall amount from $140,000 to $200,000.
And thank you very much. Senator Starr, do you have a motion?
Yes, I believe the presenter made his case, and I move Senate House Bill 2547 to the Senate floor to pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2547 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Starr, would you like to carry that? We will open a work session on House Bill 2548. Council.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, House Bill 2548 is also a bill that is sponsored by Representative Ackerman. This bill mandates arbitration in circuit court proceedings in matters for $50,000 or less. Under current law, circuit courts may choose whether they want to make arbitration mandatory for suits involving $25,000 or less or $50,000 or less. As I said, this bill would require courts to make arbitration mandatory for all cases involving $50,000 or less.
Okay. Senator Starr.
Yes, sir. Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2548 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2548 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Krasanski, would you like to carry this?
Yeah.
Okay, open the work session on House Bill 3157. Council.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, House Bill 3157A is also sponsored by Representative Ackerman at the request of Wayne County. This bill makes it discretionary for county commissioners to inspect local correctional facilities that are not operated by the county. They still are still required to inspect the correctional facilities that they do operate, but it makes it this bill makes it discretionary for them to physically inspect correctional facilities they do not operate.
Okay. Senator Brzezinski, did you have any comments to make on this before we...
I had some reservation as to just taking it completely out of their requirement. It is discretionary. I think we can just watch it and review it. There's a couple of other checks and balances in place. So the bill that we had followed on our side would have required it every other year. And I guess at this point, let's give it a try and see if there's any problems. The legislature can always come back and reinstate the mandate.
Okay. Senator Walker, did you want to say something?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I yawned, but one of the things I was looking at was this came out of the House with a 58-1 vote. Do they have a counterpart to Senator Schrader over there?
Well, I was wondering the same thing on the previous bill, Senator Walker. We'll have to check into that. I think I'll assign you to research that for the committee.
I will do that.
Okay. Senator Starr.
I'm Chair. Move House Bill 3157 to the Senate floor with the DuPage recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 3157 to the Senate floor with the DuPage recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And Senator Pazanski gets this one, too. We have 10 minutes left, so we were going to use our time to open a public hearing on House Bill 2634. Council.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, House Bill 2634A establishes pleading requirements for professional negligence actions against real estate licensees. Specifically, it requires a claimant's attorney to consult a qualified real estate licensee who will testify to admissible facts and opinions sufficient to create a question of fact as to the liability of the licensee who the claimant is suing.
Thank you. We have Jana Jarvis and Matt Farmer. I hope I was clear enough that we were going to take this if we have time. Okay.
Thank you, Chair Burdick. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jana Jarvis, representing the 15,000-plus members of the Oregon Association of Realtors. We bring House Bill 2634A to you today as a risk reduction measure for our membership. It came out of the House Civil Subcommittee unanimously, went to the full committee unanimously, and off the floor of the House unanimously. We have not had anyone up to this point in time contact with any concerns or questions about this particular bill. I've brought with me today Matt Farmer, our Associate General Counsel, to kind of walk you quickly through some of the provisions and the need for this piece of legislation.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Matt Farmer, General Counsel, Oregon Association of Realtors. You have our written testimony. I'll just briefly outline the bill for you. House Bill 2634A is a companion or a subsequent bill to what was House or Senate Bill 611 in the last term that the architects passed as a tort reform measure. This bill does essentially the same thing, which addresses a very narrow issue of pleading in professional negligence cases. And in such cases, professional expert testimony is going to be necessary in order to prosecute the case. What this bill does, what 611 did before it, was ask lawyers that if they are going to bring professional malpractice claims, that they certify at the time they bring their claim that they have an expert witness who will testify that the conduct alleged fell below the standard of care and caused the damage. That is the standard for surviving a summary judgment. And so really what the bill does is say, don't put people to the expense of going to summary judgment unless you've done your homework in having this expert testimony available. There's a saving clause in the bill. If the statute of limitations is an issue, the plaintiff's lawyer can point that out and get the certification after filing the case. There's no intent here to delay cases to make the burden. It does not change the burden in a professional malpractice case at all. It's simply a matter of trial lawyers doing their homework before they file a claim. The problem has been that the tendency is when the parties to a real estate transaction sue somebody, the lawyers just automatically name the professionals involved, hoping that they'll simply negotiate themselves out of the transaction by paying some money. And that is the purpose of this bill. I'd be happy to take any of your questions.
Okay. Any questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now we'll hear from Emily Cedarleaf.
Good
Good afternoon, Senator Burnick and members of the committee. I'm Emily Cedarleaf. I'm the executive director of the Multifamily Housing Council of Oregon and have held that position since 1979. Our portion of the industry has to do with people who have licenses that manage rental property. And since 1981, I've been directly involved with three different commissioners and four different regulation managers over at the real estate division. After 2001, the real estate division totally rewrote all the statutes and all the administrative rules, and I also provided 36 hours of training to over 500 licensees regarding the new rules, the regulations. My concern with this bill, and I apologize, I did not appear on the House side. I have had some health problems and mobility problems. And as I testified in another bill, I'm going to have to put my ego in my pocket and reduce myself to one of those little wheelie carts so that I can get around better. But at the same time that this bill was up, I also had another problem internally in our office. Our office had moved a year and a half ago, and in January we had a new tenant right kitty corner from our office who came to me and explained directly that he was moving into that office because he sells and lists rental property and thought that he would get quite a bit of traffic off the traffic at our office, which he did.
Ms. Lip, is this relevant to the
Yes,
bill?
It is.
Okay.
I found out very quickly in that process that this licensee was a registered sex offender. I had always believed that licensees that get a license from the real estate division go through a very complex process to get that license, and found out that they don't. They put in their hours, they pass the test, they submit their fingerprints, and last year the real estate division had not turned down anybody for a license. This year is a little bit different. My concern on this bill is that those that have tried to seek some assistance when they have been harmed, especially those that own rental property where the property manager has absconded with funds or misappropriated funds, that this bill will put those people in more jeopardy and not allow the statute to protect them. First of all, most listings in earnest monies have arbitration clauses into them, so those don't go to court. Any outcome of a lawsuit that results in a loss by a licensee is required to be notified to the real estate agency. And when I ask them how many have notified, so how many of these cases are going to court, their answer was that it was seldom reported. So either people are not following the reporting requirements, or there's not very many going to court. In property management, several years ago I was involved where there was 69 owners impacted by a licensee. I could line 10 people up, and none of them had a clue as to what would be considered professional standards. Currently, House Bill 2604, sponsored by OAR, will take what would be the 33 ways to lose your real estate license and reduce those to 14. Grossly changing the standards, but which would be considered professional standards. But there is no stated professional standards within the real estate regulations. OAR as an association does not represent all licensees. And so it does not mean that there are standards that those people that are non-members of OAR stand to abide by, such as my registered sex offender. Also, in this case where the real estate division opens a file then chooses not to do anything, which happens a lot, this would prevent that person from going to court if an attorney doesn't know that they have to go find an expert. And when you get into Eastern Oregon, Southern Oregon, the coast, I get subpoenaed a lot. I am not a real estate licensee because in my job as a consultant, the agency says I should not hold the license because I would be serving a dual master. But I get subpoenaed a lot as, is this normal business practice in property management? In East Oregon, you are going to find competitors testifying against one another. They're just not going to do it. I sent out 400 and some emails, got 200 of them back regarding this bill. All of them said, number one, if they were in a sales position, they would not testify against another because in a small town, they may have to present an offer to that person to present it for themselves, and they may be putting themselves in a position of jeopardy. In small towns, people are friends. They may quietly say, the guy's a derp. I'm not going to, I wouldn't do business with him, but they won't go on the public record. With my sex offender, as I dealt with it, I investigated four offices that he had worked in. All four offices had fired him. All four offices never filed the complaint with the real estate division, so nothing was on record. However, this guy does have five complaints in his file. When I asked those four agents, brokers, why they didn't report him to the agency so that something would happen, they said, we didn't want to be in the position of having to play he said, she said against our, one of the people within our industry. That's the same thing that would happen with this bill. So there are concerns.
If, could you kind of wrap up?
If there is, you know, your will and desire, what I recommend that you do is add to this bill the language that is added to and made a part of Chapter 696 so that it doesn't get stuck in another chapter, so attorneys don't get blindsided and consumers don't get blindsided. And the other issue is looking at the totality and the effect of the consumer. Yes, it reduces the problems for the licensee, but ultimately the consumer is the one that's going to be impacted by this legislation.
Thank you very much. Other questions from the committee?
Two very quick questions, Madam Chair, because I have to be in another committee. Ms. Searle, if you did indicate in your testimony you're not a real estate licensee, but are you a lawyer?
No, I'm not. I have been part of the legislative process since 1979 and have been directly involved in all of the landlord-tenant legislation passed since that point.
I have to go to another committee, and I just need to answer that question because that's pertinent to my thinking here. The second question is, in your written testimony on the last paragraph on the first page, you say, despite this past working relationship, the drafting of the bill in question and the other bill presented was done without discussion with or input from either the Oregon Real Estate Agency or any of the above-named associations. How would you know that, Ms. Sanders?
Because that's come out in House Bill 2604, and I've directly asked them. When this bill came out, I previously had been included in other discussions. I emailed Janet Jarvis. She said she didn't get it, but it was done in a vacuum. That's why it was so hard to research by the time it hit on the House side.
All right. Well, Madam Chair, Ms. Cedar, if that was regarding 2604, that isn't the bill in front of us today.
It's the same process. Both bills were created in somewhat of a vacuum.
All right. Thank you very much. Beth Senator Ackerman, were you here on this bill?
Yes.
Okay, welcome to the committee. We just passed a whole passel of your bills a few minutes ago.
Thank you. I'll be relatively brief.
For the record, Madam Chairman.
Madam Chair, if we hadn't passed those bills, he'd probably be even briefer.
Thank you for hearing my testimony, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bob Ackerman. I'm a state representative from representing Legislative District 13 in North Eugene. I had a substantial part in the preparation and even the amendments to what is now engrossed House Bill 2634. Let me just be very, very brief about what the real world is like in malpractice claims. In any malpractice claim, whether it's legal malpractice, malpractice of a physician or malpractice of a real estate agent, any type of professional malpractice, you only can prove your case if you have an expert come in and will say that the defendant's conduct was negligent and beyond the standard of care in the community. That expert must be in this case, a real estate licensee would have to be another real estate licensee or broker, someone that also had the specialized nature, specialized knowledge to make that representation. In terms of tort reform, and I think that's a misused word, and I usually use that in quotation marks, so let the record show that I put that in quotation marks. It has been quite fashionable to at least have the complaint in malpractice cases set forth the basic elements of the malpractice claim and with the certification that an expert is available to so testify in your case. What happens in many of these cases, and in the real estate industry is no exception, anyone that is a part of a complex transaction usually gets sued if something goes wrong. What happens, however, is that many of these people get dismissed later on after you go through discovery, motions to dismiss, and summary judgment types of proceedings because you don't have a professional that will testify against that person. This just forces the plaintiff filing cases of this nature, to have the expert witness up front. And that will happen, it will eliminate a lot of frivolous filings, a lot of filings where the defendants would have to defend, and when in fact the plaintiff never had an expert to begin with and was seeking some sort of a settlement. So I think it's a step in a good direction to allow the plaintiff to put all the cards on the table at once and before getting his case heard against the defendant in a malpractice claim such as this. So that's basically my testimony. I think it's a good reform bill and will eliminate some frivolous cases.
Thank you very much. Are there questions?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to comment that I'm glad that Representative Ackerman put tort reform in quotes, because I saw that in the written testimony and did not go along with it either, because that isn't what this is. So, and I really don't like that term.
I don't like it either.
But I think you're right. I think this is a good bill and does stop some of the frivolous lawsuits that we do see. And I don't have a problem with this.
Thank you. Senator Fasanzi.
Yeah, clarification. Representative Ackerman, regarding the obligation on the attorney, it's just to follow the notarized statement that they have someone, or do they actually disclose in the statement who that individual is?
I think the bill, I haven't read this in a while, but I think it requires a certification rather than a notarized statement. I'm looking at around line 11, page 1, referring to a certification.
Yeah.
I don't think it requires an affidavit. But as you well know, if you certify something in a legal document, then it's not true.
Right.
The lawyer's in big trouble.
Right. Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Representative Ackerman. We'll close the public hearing on this bill, and we will adjourn Senate Judiciary.
Well done, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Starr.
I think it's that switch right there.